Good morning. Glad to see everyone here this morning. If you happen to be visiting with us, we're so glad that you're here, and we hope and pray that you'll be back with us any opportunity that you may have. I was honored last week to be able to speak at the Church Lectures in Church, Texas. And my assignment was Zechariah chapter 7 and 8, dealing with the question asked in Zechariah chapter 7 and verse 3, and God's answer to that concerning the fast of the fifth month, as they were asking the question. And normally when I have an assignment like that, I preach it here before I go to the lectureship. Well, we're doing it in reverse this time. Preach at the lectureship, so we're going to preach it today. So I invite you to turn with me to Zechariah chapter 7. Zechariah chapter 7. And let's study together these two chapters as it pertains to this question that they have to ask of the God of heaven and their fasting. The fasting is a practice that mankind has been observing throughout the annals of history. You go and you look and you find all kinds of people from all kinds of places that use fasting, and many times it's used in connection with religion, with faith. Now, the subject of fasting is one that really I don't think is discussed much any longer, is it? As a matter of fact, I don't know that I've ever heard a particular sermon dealing with fasting from the pulpit. And so there's not much really that's going to be known about it among the brethren of the Lord's church. Now, of course, there are going to be a few that have done some extensive study upon the subject, but they're really going to be the exception to the rule. Now, as we study together this morning, we need to define fasting, and we'll look at some practices as we see in the denominational world today, and then we'll look at the text in particular. Fasting, as defined by Webster's Universal College Dictionary, is to abstain from all food or to eat only sparingly or of certain kinds of food, especially as a religious observance. Now, while there are some medical and health professionals that advocate some form of fasting as it pertains to one's health, the purpose of our study this morning is to focus upon the religious observance of fasting. So with that said, let's look at some things together. There are many denominations in the world today that look at fasting and actively encourage fasting as a sign of piety and a way to seek forgiveness of sins or a way to grow closer unto God. And you also find there are many denominations today that fasting is also in some religions, some faiths, is enforced, not just merely suggested or encouraged. And so this is something that is worth looking at. One of those such religions, not a denomination, but a religion in and of itself, is that of Islam. You may have never studied Islam in depth, but I would dare say that in our limited exposure in some cases to Islam and that religion, you've heard of the month of Ramadan, in which the Islam faith, those of Islam religion from sun up till sunset, will not eat or drink anything. And so that's something that we know about. Denominational Christianity, going back to that, you have many denominations that will encourage and some will enforce fasting, and you see that throughout denominationalism. Now let's get to our text. Zechariah chapter 7, verses 1 through 3. You see some from Bethel coming to Jerusalem. Now if you're reading the King James Version, you don't necessarily get that. Let's read together the first three verses. And I'm reading from the King James, but then I'll give you the American Standard rendering. And I really think the American Standard is a better rendering here. Of verses 1 through 3. And it came to pass in the fourth year of King Darius, that the word of the Lord came unto Zechariah in the fourth day of the ninth month, even in Cheshulu. When they had sent unto the house of God Sherezer and Regimelech and their men to pray before the Lord and to speak unto the priests which were in the house of the Lord of hosts, and to the prophet, saying, should I weep in the fifth month, separating myself as I have done these so many years? And so we see the question there in verse 3. Now the American Standard, look at verse 2. The American Standard is different from the King James in this verse. And like I said, I think it's a better rendering. Verse 2 says, now they of Bethel had sent Sherezer and Regimelech and their men to entreat the favor of Jehovah. Now, as I said, if you're reading the King James, you don't get that these men are from Bethel. You just see house of God. And that's what Bethel means. Now, they of the house, verse 2 in the King James says, they had sent unto the house of God. And that leads to a little bit of confusion. Now, if we take the King James, the house of God is nowhere in Scripture referred to as Bethel. And there doesn't really seem to be a reason to render it as the King James did. Now, why would messengers be sent to Bethel, literally the house of God, to inquire of and pray to Jehovah when his house, the temple, is being built in Jerusalem? It's there that his prophet resides, after all. As a matter of fact, when Scripture references the house of God as designated by psalmists and prophets, it's by the name Beth Elohim, not Bethel. Or more commonly, Beth Ha Elohim, or the God. Also, in the Hebrew order of words, Bethel would naturally be the subject. And so if we render it as the King James did, it would literally read as follows. Let me find my notes here. It would literally read that they of Bethel, or the house of God, sent to the house of God. And so the American Standard is really a better rendering. Now, verse 3 is the question. Verse 3, they say, and to speak unto the priests of the house of Jehovah of hosts, to the prophet, saying, should I weep in the fifth month, separating myself as I have done these so many years? My friends, here the delegation of Sherezer, Regimelech, and the men with them ask their question of God by speaking unto the priests and the prophets. And they here use the first person singular of I to indicate to the inhabitants, or indicate the inhabitants of Bethel, as a whole. And this use of the singular to indicate the whole was not really uncommon in those days. They were to address the priests and the prophets, and the prophets here mentioned would necessarily include Zechariah, as we're reading his book. They were specifically here asking about their fast occurring in the fifth month, upon the tenth day of that month. Now, this was the anniversary of the burning of the temple by Nebuchadnezzar. And so it was then, at that very time, that this fast was incorporated into the Jewish lifestyle. So 70 years, as God is going to point out here in a moment, 70 years they have been observing this fast, and they asked if they should continue to weep, separating themselves as they had done these so many years. Now, as is often the case when fasting is associated with an event such as this, weeping was part of that fast. There would be wailing, as it were, a great noise would go out, and they created these fasts to coincide with tragic events. And case in point here, the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. Now, as these fasts did coincide with such events, they would weep during the commemoration of that event. As far as separating themselves, in keeping the fast, they had separated themselves from food, from pleasures, from sin for the day, but they didn't really do that lastingly, as far as sin goes. Now, they had not given themselves wholly to God. And we see that from God's answer. God is very blunt and he's very straight to the point when he answers their question here concerning this fasting in this fifth month. And he brings up something else in a moment. I want us to notice there at the end of verse 3. They said, as I have done these so many years. It's as if they're asking the question as if they can't remember how long they've been keeping this fast. They know good and well how long they've been keeping this fast. They know good and well that it's been 70 years, but they're saying this as if they could not count them. Now, God's short answer is in verses 4 through 7. Verses 4 and 5 say, "Then came the word of Jehovah of hosts unto me, saying, Speak unto all the people of the land, and to the priests, saying, When ye fasted and mourned in the fifth and in the seventh month, even these 70 years, did ye eat, or did ye at all fast unto me, even to me?" God's first answer here, and he goes into more detail later, but his first answer is short, blunt, and right to the point. He asked them straightly, "When you fast, do you fast unto me, or are you doing it for yourselves?" And of course it's a rhetorical question, isn't it? When he says, "Have you been fasting unto me?" what is the obvious answer? No. It hasn't been for my glory. It hasn't been, haven't really anything to do with me, but it has everything to do with you. And so God is very blunt with them here. Now notice that he says that Zechariah should speak to the priests and to all the people. What this tells us, friends, is this message is not only for Bethel, is it? This message is for all the people of the land. And who is to repeat this message? The priests. God is going to give this message for all to hear, and they are to take it to others. And friends, we can take from that concerning the gospel, can't we? God has given us the gospel. What are we to do with it? Tell others. We are to show others the gospel of the God of heaven. But notice as well that God did not only answer them concerning the fifth month, but he also brought up their hypocrisy in fasting in the seventh month. Now the seventh month fast was in memory of the murder of Gedaliah and those with him at Mizpah in 2 Kings chapter 25, 25 and 26. Jeremiah also mentions that event in Jeremiah 41, 1 through 3. And so God reminds them, as if they didn't already know, as well, how long they have been keeping this fast. And you can almost hear God's anger and disgust with their hypocritical will worship. They were doing all of this for themselves, all the while saying it was for God. But friends, it's worthy to notice here that God had only authorized one fast in all of the law of Moses. So every other fast that you read about in the Old Testament was instituted by man. God did not institute this fast. He did not institute the fast of the seventh month. The only fast he authorized is found in all law of Moses was kept on the Day of Atonement, which was also on the seventh month, but the one mentioned here is not that. Now, as we noticed, this commemoration of Gedaliah, these fasts kept by the Jews in the fourth month, when a breach had been made in the walls of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, in the tenth month, commemorating when the siege of Jerusalem had begun, God didn't authorize those. But rather they had grown out of their own self-pity. Now a man named Osirias, he said this concerning basically a translation, a paraphrase of what God is saying here to the Jews. Listen to what Osirias says. He says, "Ye fasted to yourselves, not to me, for ye mourned your sorrows, not your misdeeds, and your public fast was undertaken, not for my glory, but out of feeling of your own grief, but nothing can be pleasing to God which is not referred to his glory." Why did they institute this fast? Was it because of what they had done? Was it because of their sin that had brought Nebuchadnezzar to their land? Or was it simply because of the calamities that had befallen them? It was because they saw their glorious temple destroyed. It was because they saw their great city destroyed that they started these fasts, not because of their sin, not because of anything that had to do remotely with God. This was simply a memorial for them because of their loss as they saw it. In verses 6 and 7, God again is very blunt. He says, "And when ye eat and when ye drink, do you not eat for yourselves and drink for yourselves?" In other words, when you make a feast, again, it's to your glory. Should ye not hear the words which Jehovah cried by the former prophets? When Jerusalem was inhabited and in prosperity, and the cities thereof round about her in the south and lowland were inhabited, God is beginning in verse 7 to give them a history lesson. He's reminding them of the stubbornness of their forefathers. And he reminds them of the prophets that had come to them year after year and time after time and told them, this is coming, this is coming, you need to change your ways, Babylon will come and destroy you, and yet they would not hearken. How well did the people listen to Jeremiah? How well did the people listen to Isaiah? They didn't. And look what it cost them. And that's exactly what God says there in verse 7. Should you not have heard those prophets? If they had, what would have happened? Well, Nebuchadnezzar would not have come. And so God begins in verses 8 through 14, a history lesson of sorts. And he reminds them about their stubbornness. Verse 11, look at this. He says, but they refused to hearken and pulled away the shoulder and stopped their ears that they might not hear. Friends, this reminds me so much of the present state of our country, you know, the present state of the world, really. Look what God is saying here concerning Israel. They refused to hearken. The words, the warning had been uttered. They didn't want to hear it. And I get the picture here from verse 11. I have this picture of a petulant child or a teenager, I guess you might say. His father is trying to tell him something, trying to warn him of some danger that lies ahead, that if he doesn't get his act together, if he doesn't do what's right, it's going to cause him harm. And I just have this picture in my mind of this teenager, this petulant child, pulling or yanking his shoulder away. Basically telling his father, get your hands off of me. I don't want to hear what you have to say. How often had God tried to warn these people? How often had he tried to get them to return to the fold? And yet they would not hear. And he goes on to say they stopped their ears. I have another picture. Of a child placing their hands over their ears while their father or their parent is trying to talk to them. Because they don't want to hear it. And God says that's exactly what Israel had done. Look at verse 12. Yea, they made their hearts as an adamant stone, lest they should hear the law and the words which Jehovah of hosts had sent by his Spirit by the former prophets. Therefore there came great wrath from Jehovah of hosts. Notice here that they made their hearts this way. Friends, this wasn't something that happened out of ignorance. They had the Word of God. They had it within their grasp. They had the prophets telling them what God had to say in their ears. And they stopped their ears, they covered their ears, they pulled their shoulder away, and God says they made their heart as the hardest stone, so that you could not even engrave upon it. Friends, when we turn away from God, time and time again, as He gives us warning, what happens to the heart? It gets harder and harder and harder, until at last nothing can penetrate. And that's exactly what had happened with Israel. All those acts of rebellion, all those refusals to accept the word and warnings of God had been the symptoms of a perverse heart. They didn't want to hear it. And so they turned themselves away. And it says, verse 12, that great wrath came upon them. Nebuchadnezzar came like a whirlwind, and he tore them apart. In chapter 8, God turns now to the future. He says, here was your history lesson. These prophets had come, they had spoken to you, you as a people, as a whole, you refused to listen, but now you have an opportunity. You've been brought back into this land, you've been restored to this land, Now let's look at what the future holds. Look at verses 1 and 2 of chapter 8. And the word of Jehovah of hosts came to me, saying, Thus saith Jehovah of hosts, I am jealous for Zion with great jealousy, and I am jealous for her with great wrath. Friends, right here in chapter 8 begins a heavily messianic chapter. It is very heavily messianic in that much of what we see here in chapter 8 holds both some hope for them now, as well as looking years into the future when Christ comes. When you read the word Zion in the American Standard, there are spiritual connotations attached to it. It's not talking just about physical Jerusalem. So when God says in verse 1 and verse 2 that He is jealous for Zion with great jealousy, and He's jealous for her with great wrath, He's not just talking about Jerusalem. He's talking about the church. He's looking now to the future. Now there's hope for them presently in Zechariah's day. Zechariah is going to mention here in a few moments how they're going to be able to grow old to the point now where they're going to need a cane, and they're going to be able to enjoy safety in the city where the children can play in the streets. And they couldn't do that before. There wasn't peace. But now there will be peace. And God says concerning His church in the future, notice what He says here, that He is jealous for her Zion, spiritual Jerusalem. He's jealous for her with great jealousy and with great wrath. What does that tell you, friend, about His feeling for His church, for His people? He's going to protect them, and He's going to look over. The word jealous here denotes an intense, righteous emotion. Friends, not to be confused with the vindictive, evil emotion associated with that word today. It's like a husband is jealous over his wife. That's the idea here that God is giving us. Verse 3, thus saith Jehovah, because He is jealous, He says, I am returned unto Zion, and will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem shall be called the city of truth and the mountain of Jehovah of hosts, the holy mountain. You see the spiritual connotations, friends, again, not just physical Jerusalem, but looking to the church. When could Jerusalem, in all honesty, when could Jerusalem be called physically a city of truth? Never could. When could it be called the mountain of Jehovah of hosts or a holy mountain? It couldn't, unless you're looking at the spiritual side of it. You're looking at the future. You're looking at Christ bringing the church. And so it will be called the city of truth, the faithfulness or fidelity. Now there can be no doubt that the word had an immediate application, for Jehovah says that He had returned unto Zion. But there's also no doubt, as we look further into the chapter, that it referred to a fuller and more glorious fulfillment in the present messianic period. It's looking to that church. For God had described it in the third vision as a city without walls. Now, Jerusalem was a walled city. But a city without walls, with Jehovah Himself dwelling in its midst, and as a wall of fire about it. Kaufman says this concerning this passage. The ultimate fulfillment of this glorious promise occurred when the gospel was sent forth to all nations, beginning at Jerusalem, Luke 24:47. Furthermore, there's absolutely no unlimited guarantee on God's part that He would never leave Jerusalem. It's not true that God's return to Jerusalem was an irrevocable, eternal commitment. As a matter of fact, God would again commit the city to total destruction in the generation following His bride's stubborn rejection of the gospel. Nor is there any possible denial of that in this verse. It is mandatory, then, to remember that all of God's promises are contingent upon the faith and fidelity of those whom He promises to bless. The same can be said of that verse. In verses 4 and 5, we read, Thus saith Jehovah of hosts, there shall yet old men, here He's prophesying the peace in Jerusalem, and old women dwell in the streets of Jerusalem, every man with a staff in his hand for every age. And the streets The city shall be full of boys and girls playing in the streets thereof. Peace upon Jerusalem. Thus said Jehovah, verse 6, if it be marvelous in the eyes of the remnant of this people in those days, should it also be marvelous in mine eyes, saith Jehovah of hosts? Now it seems that the people can't believe what they're hearing. We're actually going to experience peace. We're actually going to be able to grow old. We can see this coming now. God, are you being... God says, is it really that hard to imagine? What do we know concerning the promises of God? He's faithful concerning His promises, right? So if God has promised it, what can we count on? It's going to come about. It's going to happen. And so God says, even though it can be it's amazing or marvelous in your eyes, is there anything too hard for me? And of course, God's answer is no. Behold, verses 7 and 8, I will save my people from the east country and from the west, and I will bring them, and they shall dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, and they shall be my people. Now listen to what's said here. They shall be my people, and I will be their God in truth and in righteousness. Friends, he's looking toward the church. He's looking to the future. In verses 9 through 13, basically and essentially what God says is, don't be like your fathers. Don't turn your ear from me. Don't cover your ears. Don't pull your shoulder from me. Hear the present prophets. Listen to what Zechariah has to say. Listen to what Haggai has to say. Listen to me, God says. Then, verses 14 through 17, God promises them good. And again, we know concerning God's promises that He will keep them. Finally, I want us to look at verses 18 through 23. God finally answers their original question. He finally gets back to this question of fasting for them. And again, He reminds them that their reason for fasting was not a good one. They were fasting because of the destruction of Jerusalem, because of the destruction of temple, because of the murder of Gedaliah. They were tragic events, no doubt, but they weren't fasting because of their sin. They were fasting because of their sorrow. And God says, that's not right. Verses 18 and 19. And the word of Jehovah of hosts came unto me, saying, thus saith Jehovah of hosts, the fast of the fourth month, and the fast of the fifth, and the fast of the seventh, and the fast of the tenth shall be to the house of Judah joy and gladness and cheerful feast. Therefore, love, truth, and peace. What had they been in love with before? Their sorrows. But God says here, therefore, love, truth, and peace. He's telling them now, turn your fast into feast. Turn your fast into gladness and cheerful feast and joy. Now up until this point, God had given no direct answer concerning the original inquiry. He had answered them generally. He'd asked them some rhetorical questions, but He had not given a direct answer. Now the fourth fast, as we mentioned a few moments ago, they had been keeping in memory of Nebuchadnezzar's coming against Jerusalem, the tenth month, the breach made in the wall in the fourth month, the burning of the temple in the fifth month, and the murder of Gedaliah in the seventh month. And God says, they shall be to the house of Judah joy and gladness and cheerful feast. And so it seems here that God had really been neither pleased nor displeased with the observances of these fasts. God says, I could care less, or I couldn't care less about what you've been doing concerning these fasts. They matter not to me. They rather to God had been a matter of indifference. The sins of the people were what had brought about the judgment. And so all of that, those sins had been displeasing to Him, just as the righteousness He now demands will be pleasing to Him. God says, therefore, love, truth, and peace, friends, for it's on that basis that God will turn their sadness to joy and their fast to feast of gladness. And so Zechariah, in effect, then cancels the fast altogether. Look at verses 20 and 21. Thus saith Jehovah of hosts, it shall yet come to pass, that there shall come peoples. Again, he's going to look to the future again. He's looking toward the new testament. He's looking toward the coming of Christ and the coming of the church. That there shall come peoples, and the inhabitants of many cities, and the inhabitants of one city shall go to another, saying, let us go speedily to entreat the favor of Jehovah, and to seek Jehovah of hosts. I will go also. Dumelo says this concerning this passage. The gathering in of the nations was never adequately fulfilled in regard to Jerusalem or the temple. And so what does it have to refer to? It has to refer to the church. The prophecy foretells most strikingly the success of the kingdom of Christ. It was the dream of all Hebrew prophecy. This promise found its complete fulfillment in the Messiah. Verses 22 and 23, yea, many peoples and strong nations shall come to seek Jehovah of hosts in Jerusalem and to entreat the favor of Jehovah. Thus saith Jehovah of hosts, in those days it shall come to pass that 10 men shall take hold. Out of all the languages of the nations, they shall take hold of the skirt of him, Jesus, that is a Jew, saying, we will go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. Continuation there of what we just read a moment ago. Friends, it's noteworthy that they shall take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew. That's a reference to Jesus and his very name means God with us. And friends, this chapter ends, the first section of Zechariah, and all the visions and direct revelations serve as an introduction for the rest of this prophecy. Now friends, how incredible must this prophecy have seemed to the enemies of Israel? Who could have believed that a little handful of despised returnees would yet see the whole world turn to one of them for redemption and salvation? And yet it's been gloriously fulfilled. Jesus has come, and he's turned our sorrow into joy. He's taken away the sins of the world. Now concerning fasting and some lessons learned from this passage, these chapters. Friends, it's important that we understand just how important absolute obedience is in spirit and in truth to the commands of God. Jehovah was very plain spoken. God was very plain spoken with the people when they asked about their customary fast, and he told them in no uncertain terms that he was more concerned with their spiritual lives than what they were eating or not eating and drinking or not drinking. Now, as we earlier noted with some of the customs of many religious groups concerning fasting, it seems that many put their trust in places they need not put their trust. Rather than simply keeping the commandments of God, some believe that somehow fasting is going to bring them closer to the God of heaven. Believing such things, friends, could not really be further from the truth. As he plainly put here to those that asked this question, he's really indifferent toward those things. He's more interested in being obedient to his word. And you think about these things, and what comes to mind to me is Samuel's words to King Saul. Samuel said, hath Jehovah as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of Jehovah? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams. Friends, it doesn't get any more plain than that. These fasts that the people were observing were public fasts. It was a show as what it had become. But the scriptures are full of examples of followers of God that went about their service to God quietly and efficiently because they made their hands strong. Zechariah chapter 8, verses 9 and 13. We can speak of Daniel and how he continued to serve the Lord without a claim in a foreign land. We can speak of Moses and how he was the meekest man in all the earth, Numbers 12 and verse 3. And the list could go on for days. If you decide to fast, friends, and you do so for spiritual reasons, well and good. But the whole world doesn't have to know about it. Since so much of the prophecy, friends, centers upon the coming Messiah, why don't we ask how God, how Jesus felt about how one ought to serve the Almighty God? In His speaking to the woman at the well, found recorded in John chapter 4, Jesus said to the woman that they that worship Him, God, must worship in spirit and in truth. Friends, Jesus quite simply here tells the woman and all those that would worship God, and friends, are we listening? We must worship in spirit and in truth. God is the object of our worship and He is the audience. And friends, as such, I must worship Him with all that I am. That means my emotion, my attitude, my sincerity, my love, my whole being is to be put into my worship under the Almighty. And I have to do that in just the way that He has prescribed. Anything more or anything less is not pleasing in God's sight. And so, friends, let's remember that God is God. And to try to make Him out to be anything less than that is not only slighting Him, but we're doing ourselves a disservice. Let us be more interested in obedience to the Almighty than anything else. Let's put away our Bibles. Let's take out our song books. We're ready to sing the invitation song here in just a moment. Friends, it may be that you're here this morning and you haven't been obedient to the God of heaven. You haven't put Christ on in baptism. Friends, if you're here this morning and you've never obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ, there's no better time than the present. It's cold outside, but the water behind me is warm. So friend, if you're here this morning having never obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ, why not this morning put Christ on in baptism? Be buried with Him, burying the old man of sin. Arise again to walk in newness of life, a new creature. Obeying the God of heaven. Being one with Him and being added to His church. Friend, if you're here this morning and you have obeyed the gospel, have you remained obedient? Do you still belong to the God of heaven? And friend, if you're on the outside looking in, why not come back? Why not come home? Be His once again. Friend, if you have a need, if you're subject to the Lord's invitation, we ask that you come while we stand and while we sing.